So this is my favorite topic, because we can, as Jews, we can laugh about God. How do you like that? And at the same time, embrace God. It's like a relationship, you know? You can't live with him, you can't live without him. So I'll begin with a story that happened many years ago in my career. So I began teaching long before many of you were born. Yeah, that's a compliment. And my eyesight is good with my glasses. So 1981, 82. So were any of you around yet? You don't have to raise your hands, please. Okay. But it was definitely the dinosaur age, because there was no email or text or internet. I used a typewriter. Some of you know what a typewriter is, right? Yeah. And mail was delivered then by donkeys and camels. Yeah, that's an archaic institution, yeah. So I was actually working then, some of you at yesterday's session, that my main work was really behind library walls in a way, writing, recreating and writing the Rebbe's talks. That was my complete involvement. But I get a call one day from a friend in Miami. He says, I have someone in New York who's looking for spiritual inspiration. He's a secular Jew, whatever that means, and maybe you want to talk to him. So I said, look, I'm not finished writing the talk for each Shabbos until around Wednesday or Thursday. So if he comes Thursday night, I'll be happy to talk to him. So he came with a friend of his, and they were basically both that time, I think they were promoters of musical events and boxing events. And he was a businessman, the other fellow was a promoter. And he came to my office, I remember, they came to my office and we hit it off. And then they asked if they can come back next week, and then another week. And then they began bringing their lawyer and their accountant and their friends and their some musicians. And the musicians brought more musicians. And this was like this arts and entertainment almost type of group. Mostly Jews, some non-Jews as well. Very spiritual, but not in any way traditional Jewish in any way. If anything, they were the classic cynics about anything that was tradition, because they went through, what was that film from the brothers, that, you know, that Ordinary Man or something, that about the Jew, the irrelevance of Judaism in our times? You remember that one? What was it called, Ordinary Man? Serious Man, yeah. That was Judaism was a joke at best. But they were very spiritual, so it was a very powerful type of interaction, because I came from my side of the world, they came from their side of the world. You know, if you ask them where they got their spirituality from, they would say, please come in, or you're just checking out. If you ask them where they got their spirituality from, they'd say from Zen Buddhism, and from a thing that, let's call it, it's not an acronym for let's start davening. Got it? Okay, LSD. And because time is limited, I can't regale you with these long marathon nights where they shared their acid trips with me and how they went back into prehistoric times or whatever it was. And I shared with them my experiences of learning Shaar Yichud V'Amunah and the Rebbe's Fabringens about how entire of existence is really spiritual energy. But it was very, very fascinating interaction, because their background and my background, and it was very enriching for me. It really became the beginning of a class that I still give till this day. Now it's Wednesday night, and I kid you not, the class has never stopped for now, what is it, 82, 81 till now, talking about 38 years. And probably around 30,000 people have come to this class, if I could estimate correctly. So I got to know a lot of people through this. And at that time, I had no dream that I would ever be an author or a writer or a speaker. I was writing Fabringens. It was written in Yiddish, and it was on a scholarly level. As I said, it was a very academic work. So it's been a journey. The reason I share this is not just to share my background, but really share with you some one powerful event among many. So here I was sitting there, the yarmulke and a beard. It was blacker then than now. I had a little more hair on top of my head as well, if you noticed. And I realized, you know, just instinctively that I'm sitting here with people who have no clue who I am, and they may be stereotyping me. They may be stereotyping me because I don't project a neutral image. And they may think maybe I remind one of them of an angry grandfather that schlepped him to synagogue at Yom Kippur against his will, or irrelevant Hebrew school teacher that taught hollow bat mitzvah lessons, or maybe someone that cheated them in business who happened to call themselves Orthodox. You've heard that does happen. And or maybe even good memories, nostalgic memories, but definitely not neutral. So I tried an experiment which in many ways has literally been, like, for me, definitive in a certain sense. I decided I'm not going to speak about anything with any religious or Torah terms. Everything would be in plain secular English. So I eliminated anything that would sound Jewish or religious. The only thing Jewish in the room was me and them, but without any identifications. So instead of God, I used the word higher reality, or the essence of it all. Or for as a particularly new age group, I used an expression like non-defined unconscious energies, you know? And instead of Torah, I used the word blueprint. Instead of mitzvahs, connections. And instead of Mashiach and Geula, I used the destination. And there I was pontificating and waxing eloquent about a journey to the essence of reality, following this blueprint, making connections, fusing the inner and the outer until you reach a destination where there's a seamless integration between spirit and matter, between the unconscious and the conscious, between form and function, between the undefined and the defined, and between the indeterministic and the deterministic. And there we go. And here I was going on and on about this, and I must tell you, they were fixated. They were like mesmerized by it. They said, wow, this is great stuff. I've never heard anything like this. After a few weeks of doing this, one fellow came over to me. I don't know if you remember a group called Jay and the Americans. Okay, in the 60s, a few big hits, rock hits. So a member in the group, Jay Black, was the head of the group. He was actually Jewish, and he learned cantorial lessons from the Chazan Kosovitsky, which why their music is somewhat cantorial-like. Yeah, did you know that? Anyway, there was a person in the group was a singer in the group. His name was Kenny Vance. His name was once Rosenberg. He changed it to Vance. And he says to me before the class, comes over to me, he says, you've been talking about these ideas. They're great ideas, and everybody's really fascinated. Are you talking about God, you know? So I said to him, yes, but don't spoil it for the others, you know? And slowly I began to reveal my original words. But why I'm sharing this was because the experiment worked far beyond my expectation. How trapped we are with words. More than we can ever imagine. You know, we live in a day of communications, right? Every therapist tells you, can't keep it inside you. She's not gonna, he'll never know what you feel unless you express yourself. Break the silence, right? So it's all about talking, to the point maybe some people say too much talking. Like the guy that went to the priest, the Jew, and he says he wants to confess his sins, and the priest was so taken that a Jew came to him. He says, my son, how did you come see the light? He says, don't take it personally. I'm telling everybody, you know? So there's a point of communication. You know, you're like, at some point, you're quiet for years. You're oppressed for 30 years, and then you can't stop. And I don't mean to be insensitive in any way to anybody if you're in one of those two groups. So we speak, we talk, and we think words connect us. And they do very often. Because if you don't express yourself, how is anyone supposed to know what you're thinking? especially a loved one, a close one. But words can also be barriers, because a word that means nothing to you, it could be innocuous to you, to your spouse, or to someone else, can be a word that their mother used every time she got upset and went ballistic. So words are loaded. And the most loaded words of all, without question in my mind, are religious words. A word like God is literally meaningless. Honestly, if we passed out now a note to each one of your cards, describe God in two sentences, and I'm getting beyond the prerequisites, supreme being, creator, first cause, whatever, or some philosophical idea, but some personal, I don't think two people would write the same thing. So it's a three-letter word used all the time, all on our currency, in God we trust, and we think everybody agrees to what the definition of God is. And it's not true at all. We don't. And then debates break out. I'm a believer, you're a non-believer, atheist, agnostic, believer. I remember once writing an article about atheists, agnostic believers, and I got a letter from the president of the American Atheist Association. I kid you not. And he writes to me, he says, just like you write there's 5 or 20 or 40 shades of believers, you know that atheists, we also have a bunch of levels. He says they're radical atheists, they're moderate atheists, and they're liberal atheists. There's a whole bunch of things. I wasn't even aware of that, the nuances in atheism. I didn't get a letter from the American Agnostic Association, but I'm sure there's a bunch of nuances there too. And the debates break out, and no one states the terms. Do you ever see a contract? The first thing in the contract, what are the terms? Meaning the terms, who is who? Who's the owner, who's the buyer, etc. What are the terms? Define the word God before we disagree. And one of my favorite expressions that goes back to Rav Levi Yitzchak Baditshever, the great 18th century Hasidic Rebbe, was that a self-proclaimed atheist who lived nearby him, so the Rebbe invited him for Rosh Hashanah. So he said, Rebbe, you know, I don't believe. What's the point? So the Rebbe said to him classic words. He said, the God you don't believe in, I also don't believe in. Think about that. In other words, let's first define God. So if God, with most of us, and I can't speak for every one of you, we went through education, went through a course on God. Yes, if you had some prerequisite philosophical courses, they gave you some of the interpretations. Who taught us about God exactly? Where do we learn about God? We pick it up in our homes, for good or for bad. And that usually becomes the image. For many of us, it's a nursery school image of a man with a white long beard sitting on a throne in heaven, waiting to strike us with lightning when we misbehave. Or a version of that. You know? So if someone said, I believe in God, and they described God like that, what would I say? I'm a full-blown atheist too. I don't believe in that God. So it's all about the terms. So tell me the terms of God, and then we'll talk whether we're debating or not. So I find it like so fascinating that we can have these debates that go on forever, and the terms are never defined, when really we may be even agreeing or disagreeing in equal terms. And that's obviously the whole theme of this conversation here. And I, as a natural skeptic myself from the youngest age, I always struggled with this, because I was brought up in an environment with a lot of God talk. This was my community called Crown Heights, USA, Chabad community, and God was mentioned every second. And many good people. I'm not suggesting I get brought up with bad type of God, but I never really saw someone define it in a way that I can relate to. It was like, then you start asking the question as you get a little older and say, so what do they really mean? What do you mean? What does this one mean? So maybe in purer times, like 500 years ago, we lived in a more insulated world. So then it could be we picked up the spirit of what God meant in the smell of the chicken soup in our grandmother's kitchens. And it was an insulated community environment. You didn't have any other influences. There were no internet. There was no technology. You didn't even travel. You were usually born and died in the same city, and you knew the 100 or 200 families, and that was it. Simple life. Beautiful in many ways, very oppressed, materially usually, but in many ways also very naive, but a healthy naivete, an innocence. It's like a child growing up like children. I'm sure there were skeptics and there were those that challenged, but how many Jews really left. They couldn't even leave if they wanted to, because the non-Jewish world wouldn't take them. The only way was through extreme measure, through baptism, God forbid, through conversion, which was a very small number. Everything, of course, is different today. We live in a world that's every way antithetical to that. Yes, some of us may have grown up in a home where the chicken soup was enough, or the environment, and even without spelling out words, we just picked up the spirit. I could say I was fortunate enough to have some of that. I grew up in my parents' home, my grandparents' home. There were certain things that were just beautiful. I saw it without words. You know, I saw the love of my grandparents without them speaking about it. They didn't have to say it all the time. And my parents. But I also saw some things I didn't like that much. And not everyone grew up in such homes. It's not a guarantee. And today we have to articulate, because if we don't, we could end up stuck with unhealthy and dysfunctional translations and definitions of God and Torah and mitzvahs and Mashiach and Geula. And I assure you, we don't have the time. If we really had the time, we could spend the next 3-4 hours and go around the room and ask each of you, tell me what you think in few words about each of these words I just said, God, Torah, mitzvahs. You'll be surprised how others have very different interpretation, or how your interpretation is very shallow, you never really articulated it. And it's not a critique. Because again, what did our education teach us? I wish someone when we were in high school would say, let's talk about God. I'll tell you a story I heard from a Rabbi Shlomo Tachtel, who comes to a daily class I give in New York. He grew up in Israel. He went to a very frum school called the Brisker Iluyim, the Geniuses of Brisk. Very Talmudic school, very non-Hasidic school in Jerusalem. One day, an American wanders in there it was probably 1966, with a red, he thought it was a wig, because they didn't see these things, but it wasn't a wig. It was a big red, what do you call it, whatever. Not an afro, whatever, very curly hair, red hair, whatever, you get the idea. I don't have the word for it. We have to think about the words, you know. Okay, there we go. I don't know what that means, but it sounds good. I'll use it next time. You don't always use words, you know. You just use it, you know. So, anyway, he comes in. He's an American boy. He wandered in there. He sees a bunch of scholars sitting in a Talmud. So he says to them in English. So they didn't know English. One of them spoke a little English, so he translated. He said, can someone, why am I here? I came to discover in Jerusalem. I want to find out about God. What did Jews say about God? Now, what better place is in a yeshiva, right? They're studying Talmud all day and all night, and they're geniuses. They're proficient scholars. And Rabbi Tachtel tells me, we were all dumbfounded. Everyone looked at each other. He said, do you know anything about God? You know? Do you know anything? If you ask me about the nuances of what makes a piece of meat kosher or not, they can go on for months, if not years. And they immediately looked at each other. It was like, so he said, no one knows about God. So they said, maybe you should, you know. They didn't even think that their Rosh Yeshiva, meaning the head of the academy, would know. So someone says, I think there's someone in Jerusalem, his name is Rabbi Usher Lemel Cohen in Meir Sha'arim, that may know something about God. You can imagine? In Jerusalem, I'm not exaggerating this at all. It's exactly how he described it to me. He may know something. So what they did, a pilgrimage, there we go. They knew that the guy with the red hair and 5-6 students who were all very curious went along. They go to Jerusalem. They said, you know what? They went, I think it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. They said, we'll be back for Mincha, like at 2. They thought, you know, take 10, 15 minutes until they get there. So they come there. Yeah, he's there in the basement, sitting there in one of his places where he's teaching. He's a Chabad Chassidish guy, Usher Lemel Cohen, and he has a gift of speech, of... And they ask him. He didn't speak English either. They had a translator who knew both Hebrew and English. And he went on 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 hours talking about God. Now, the redhead was impressed, but you know who was really impressed? The yeshiva guys. They can't believe there's a Jew on earth that can talk about God for more than 30 seconds. This is a story. I've not embellished it. You can check it out. It even shocked me. It shocked me because, not that I didn't know this is a fact, but it's so embarrassing. So you can learn about everything God wants and nothing to say about the God that wants it from us. So you tell me, you don't have to be a brilliant, semi-intelligent person has a conversation with a Torah scholar and can't tell you anything about God. What kind of respect are you going to have about the Torah that this guy's teaching you what God wants of you? And this is not, I hope no one takes this as Lashon Hara. Didn't mention any names. So, because I'm not trying to be critical, I'm just being realistic. And it's vital that we know this. So as I think I said in one of my other sessions, I find the greatest challenge in talking about all these matters in Judaism is not conveying ideas, but in dispelling stereotypes. So very often in these type of talks, the only way, I mean, here, I believe I have a captive audience in the sense it's not a hostile audience. You know, and I've spoken to hostile audiences. And there, the only way to really get across is you have to identify with them. So you have to almost make like all these God jokes. And who's the best source for them is Woody Allen, of course. Because he has all the cynical jokes about God and about Judaism and about so on, which are actually painful. They're anti-Semitic, really. But they convey a message because you see how people laugh. I'll just share two of them, if I may. And this is not to make you laugh. It's really to convey the tragedy of how much we don't know about God. And the more we understand what we don't know, the more we'll be able to know, which, of course, is what I'm leading to. So it was one, a small intro, it was one night, Christmas night. You've heard of this day? It's not a Jewish holiday. It's called Nittel in some of the Jewish circles. So it's a night some people don't learn Torah till midnight. So I get a call from a rabbi in Upper West Side. He says to me that the stand-up comedy club called Stand Up New York, you know, they have these thematic nights, that tonight it's rabbi night. Which means instead of their lineup of comedians, they include a few rabbis. They do this, you know, sometimes accountants and sometimes business people and so on and so forth. Would you want to be one of the rabbis? So I immediately said, no, I don't do stand-up comedy. I need half an hour just to warm up and a half hour to land. Here, a comedy thing is 6 minutes, and you got to make people laugh, and it can be quite humiliating if nobody laughs. I know what a comedy club is. But then, before we hang up, I said, no, that sounds too cowardly. I always like a challenge. Okay, I'll do it. Okay, yep, try it out. It's very, very humbling, I can tell you that. So I come, and I hoped all night that there was such a lineup I'd never get to the stage, to be honest. But I was there, and yes, I did get to the stage, and most of the rabbis bombed. So I really saw how bad it can be. Because you're standing in a room with 900 people, all smoked up, and they're like close to you, not even closer. You're like in a lower stage, surrounded. And if they don't laugh, it's not pleasant, you know? And some of the rabbis were resorting to the most ridiculous, dirty jokes I ever heard, and they didn't even laugh at those. So there I get up, and I said, you know what? I have to use my rabbi jokes. This is the time. So I shared the first. I also felt I had to tell a narrative, so I did it through humor. Actually, it worked. I'm not going to do it again, but that's why I'm here. I'm testing the waters, okay? That's what you do. So so the first one, which of course, the first joke is most important because you have to get their attention. And I said, listen, it may work, it may not work. What can I do? I got to take the risk. So two guys get lost in a hot air balloon. And they're looking around and thinking, okay, how do we get out of this place? Where are we? They yell down, they see a guy below, and they say, hey. And he says, what? He says, do you know where we are? And he says, yes, you're in a hot air balloon. And then a gust of wind comes and whisks them away. And one looks at the other and says, what was that? So the guy says, that was definitely a rabbi. He says, how do you know? Because what he said was true but irrelevant. You know, okay, I see there's too much respect for rabbis in this room. In the comedy club, everybody laughed, okay? And then I told the second one, which is even sadder. And that's the one where the guy comes to the rabbi and says, Rabbi, I hear the Torah has all the secrets of the truth. Will you share it with me? He says, of course. He says, how much will it cost? How could I charge you? God didn't charge Moses. Moses didn't charge the people. It's free. So he was doubly impressed. He's getting the secrets of life. And free? Okay, they sit down, they open up the Torah, And it's, of course, all in Hebrew. So the rabbi says, Hebrew lessons will be $20,000, you know. Okay. So why do I tell these jokes? Because there are hundreds of them like this. As I said, Woody Allen made them popular. Because they feed into, they get you to laugh, but they also feed into something that's very real. That rabbis may be nice people. The Torah may have a lot of truths. But either someone's trying to cash in on it, or it's not personally relevant. And let's be very blunt and honest. If you had a personal problem in your life, whether it's with a spouse, whether it's with your children, whether it's at work, whether it's your own demons that you're struggling with, would you open up a parsha in the Torah to find an answer? So most of us initially would go into denial. That's solution number one, presumed solution. Maybe therapy. Maybe some advice. Why wouldn't you open up a parsha? We're told the Torah is chayenu ve'erech yameinu. It's our life and our sustenance, and it has all the answers. It's God's book. It's better than any man-made system. So the answer is very straightforward. Some of us will say, you know what? It may be in the Torah, but I have no idea how to find it. And I have no rabbi to help me find it. Some will say, I don't know if the Torah was given for things like that. The Torah tells me when Shabbos begins and what to do, what songs to sing, what to eat, what not to eat. Who says it deals with the soul, with the psyche? And then you ask yourself, one second, God created just a Torah just to tell us what to eat and what not to eat, and when Shabbos begins, or what you do on Passover or on Rosh Hashanah, and what God didn't create the soul, and God told us nothing about the soul, nothing about the psyche. Even if you never articulate that, the mere fact that we don't hear that the Torah tells us about that tells you that maybe it has nothing to say. And what does that leave us with? That this God and this Torah that Jews have worshipped for 3,300 years plus does not have personal relevance to our daily lives. I know you may have never heard it from a rabbi, so I'm stating it. I don't believe that's the case. That's why I'm stating it. But I know it's the case because that's what we're left with. I remember a person coming to my class, and he started to go to shul afterwards. First time he went to synagogue. He went to a synagogue in Manhattan, very Orthodox synagogue. And he calls me up after Shabbos, like, you know, almost in like shock. He says to me, you know, you've been teaching on the Torah as a blueprint for life. So I couldn't wait till the Torah being read. They opened up the Torah scroll, and the guy starts reading. I don't know what parsha it was. And they're reading, and I'm waiting to hear. You know, people say, wow, this is such a personal message for me. This is an insight I never heard. Instead, I hear a guy yelling at the reader of the Torah. He's saying, no, it doesn't say Vayikach, it says Vayikoch. You know, I don't know if in these synagogues you always have this self-appointed fixers, they're called. They fix the reader. Why? Because you have to be very precise in the reading, which is fine. And they want to make sure that no one mispronounces. And this is what he's been sitting. He says, so I thought maybe, okay, some nutcase. Then I hear another guy from the other corner, another correction. And that's what it became. The Torah reading was like a guy reading words I don't understand. Nothing seemed relevant. And the only thing was arguing about how you pronounce words. So, you know, he was like a little humorous about it, but I saw it was pained him in a way. So, of course, I told him, don't you know that beneath the pronunciations, there's all sorts of secret codes. They were talking in code. He said, who are you kidding? I talked to these guys afterwards. They don't even know how to talk regular. They don't know any code, you know? You know? So I try to tell them that. But the point of all these stories is not, as I said, just to be cynical, but rather to talk openly, because there's an expression, Yedias Hamach Lechetzi Refuah. Awareness of a problem is half the cure. And if we don't know what the problem is and you can't articulate it, you will never find a solution. That's why I find it vital to say things like this, even if they're somewhat dismissive and actually expose parts of, let's call it, our community that is not living up to its objectives. So then are we surprised then when people say, oi, the young people don't come to shul anymore? Why are you surprised? What are you talking about? What's the competition like? Why would someone, if someone has a choice to go to a rock concert or to a party or to some other entertainment, or to go hear the Torah reading in shul, why is it surprising to you? Now, obviously, of course, it pains me as well. I would love them to believe that the reading of the Torah or hearing Shachris, Mincha, Ma'ariv, and all other things in shul should touch them, but it's not. So what does a good person who's running a business do? You don't say, oh, the customers are all wrong. You say, maybe I'm not doing it right. To blame the customers or the potential customers, I think somewhat insane. Maybe we rabbis are not teaching it correctly. You ever thought of that? And it's not about that the Torah is wrong. The problem is we're not teaching it correctly. And the only way you could teach it correctly is if you go and dispel the stereotypes. And the only way to do that is to spell out the stereotypes, because many of them are true. Do you think that the rejection of religion in our generation came by accident? So many people say, oh, it was all the birth of science, the enlightenment. That's the curse. No, that wasn't a curse. It was a challenge. It suddenly forced all religious people to look at themselves. You know what? Maybe you can't explain. You don't need to explain a volcano as being only a punishment of gods. Maybe there's natural reasons, understanding the science. The problem was that religion did not rise to the occasion in most cases. And it saw it as a battle. The only way was to silence Galileo because he's discovering heretical conclusions. And what does that leave us with? That the only way to win is to silence the other voice. That's exactly, that doesn't sound very secure to me. And growing up, how many people have told me, what I know, remember my Jewish education was all about silencing. They didn't invite questions. If I asked a question that was a little touchy, you're not allowed to ask that, or you're punished for asking, or you're dismissed. What does that all tell you? And this is not, these are not what I'm talking about anomalies. This is unfortunately very much part of the system, and I can include even the system I grew up with to some extent. So what's the good news, right? I only have a few minutes to tell you the good news. No, a little more than that. The good news is that all this, these distortions are actually not Judaism, and they're not Torah, and they're not God. And that's why it's vital to challenge all those terms. So then what is it then? Well, one of the beliefs, the reason I am here, the JLI conference, the JLI retreat, and why I've dedicated my entire life to teaching and to writing, is a reason. It's not like because nothing else to do. It's because I feel this is the challenge of our time. And back, when, as I said, those of you who were here Wednesday night when I spoke about mission, talked about my own journey when I began at 17, I discovered that if I don't dedicate my life to something I believe in completely with a passion, to a real need, which is to exactly talk about these matters and to describe Torah in a way that is relevant, I will have, in a way, squandered maybe the purpose of why I came to this world. Now, don't get me wrong. This is not coming from any arrogant place where I think I'm the only one that can do it or I think everyone can do it. That's what I learned from the Rebbe. I learned a methodology that cuts through the conventional human definitions of these terms and helps us access the Torah and Judaism and God in a personally resonating way. Whenever I speak, especially to skeptics, I'm called a rabbi of atheists, by the way, in Manhattan by a number of people, because atheists relate to me for some reason, because I know the argument. I know the argument, I'm not afraid of it, because I believe we face it head on and there's something to say. So there was a guy coming to my class, he was in the finance world, and he's sitting and I see really listening. After a few weeks, he comes over to me and he says to me, you know, I love your classes, but I have to tell you something out of respect. I'm a full-fledged atheist. So he tells me. And why is he telling it to me? Because he wants me to know. You know, he's respectful, he wants me to know. So I said, but I mentioned God in the classes. He says, your God I have no problem with. I promise you. I've been getting the recordings of your classes and I've been sending them to my parents who are even more atheists than I am. My father is a psychiatrist, and my mother is intellectual property attorney. They lived in Cherry Hill, and they want to come now because they've been listening and they like it too. They're going to be coming next week, but they want me to tell you, forewarn you, that they're atheists, you know. So I didn't say this to him, but I said, oh, they're these such atheists I love. They're more respectful than the believers, you know. So they come, Arthur and Estelle, they were their names, and finest people, sweethearts. They had met, who knows, when they were 14 years old and never looked at anyone else and married for how many years. So they were that type. I got to know them, unbelievable people, unbelievable. The most honest people I've ever met. They talked about, why they were telling me was more than just being respectful. They wanted to be honest, honest. One day, Arthur and Estelle call me. They want to take me to dinner. So we go to a kosher restaurant in Manhattan. They have a question. Arthur has a question. This is what he's asked me. You tell me this is not, it will bring you to tears. Miraculous story, like a Baal Shem Tov story, says to me, with his wife sitting there. So the reason we wanted to talk to you is because I've been learning from you, your teaching, and I love it and all that. And I want to start putting on tefillin. I never talked to him about tefillin. I mean, I talked about it, but I never about him personally. I want to put on tefillin. So I said, so what does Estelle think? Sure, great idea. So I said, so what's the problem? Why do you need to take me out to dinner to ask me about this, you know? He says, because I don't believe in God. That's what he said to me. He said, I don't believe in God. And does it make sense I should put on tefillin if I don't believe in God? Do you ever hear such a question? So I was like, so I said, well, first of all, what difference does it make, you know? So he said, so why should I put on tefillin? So I said, you're asking me. You said you want to put it on. Then he says to me, but why? Give me a reason. So I said, because you're Jewish, and Jews put on tefillin. He started crying like a baby. He started crying. Now, he didn't just start putting on tefillin. He asked me to come to me to Crown Heights. He went to the best scribe, and he bought the biggest tefillin on the market. I mean, and when you say big tefillin, I'm talking about it's almost as big as your head. And he put it on, and he loved it. Every day he's putting on tefillin. And he's telling me, I don't know, is there God? Is there no God, you know? And then they tell me they started keeping Shabbos. Yeah. And they still don't know, they don't believe in God. And they made it clear, it's not agnostic. So he says to me, they both tell me, they said to me, well, we're going step by step. We have every 4 weeks we do a maxi Shabbos, which means complete, Friday night and Shabbos. And the other 3 weeks it's a mini Shabbos, which means only Friday night, and Shabbos day is not complete. Not complete, I'm wondering already what not complete by these non-God-fearing people is like, you know? This is a story. They got older, and he bought every book. I was in his house once. When she passed away, I was in his house, and full with the whole Jewish library was there, every medrash, and this, and I could saw it was worn out. He's sitting shiva for his wife, and these are the words he tells me. He was already older. He says to me, I don't know if there's a heaven, but if there's a heaven, Estelle is there. He was honest. I couldn't believe the scrupulous honesty. It was like mind-blowing. He passed away. I knew they couldn't be apart for long. He passed away a little while later. So his children asked me to speak at his funeral. So I told the story about the heaven. He said, I don't know if there's a heaven, but if there is one, she's there. And I said, let me tell you this. I know this couple and their family for now 6 years, 7 years. I've never met more God-fearing people in my life. And they still would not say they believe in God. And I'll tell you something, their not belief was more belief in God than most people say they believe in God. Do I need to explain what I mean? Because they were honest and they did not philosophically could really relate to it. But emotionally they knew it. He wouldn't put on tefillin, keep Shabbos and so on. But he couldn't, his mind, and most importantly, which I never really explored because I found it to be sacred ground, to be honest. I really found it sacred. I didn't even want to ask questions. I didn't want to like say to him, so tell me how exactly you reconcile it, blah, blah. But I always speculated because he shared with me some things that he grew up in a home that was extremely abusive and especially religiously unhealthy. So his rejection of God was not the real God. It was exactly what Lev Yitzchak Baditshuva said, the God you don't believe in, I don't believe in. So the question then is in our lives, so what do we do? What do we do? In many ways, I can tell you, Rabbi Epstein, where are we? Okay. In many ways, you may find this odd, but it's not odd at all. I was drawn far more to speak to secular people who don't believe in God or have nothing, no knowledge than to religious people, to be honest. It's only the last 7, 8 years I got involved with the religious community. Really, seriously. But trust me, I'm not anti-Semite, and some of my best friends are Jews and religious Jews. So, you know, But why? Because I found it easier to talk. There's an expression, it's better to know nothing about something than to know half about something. Because people who think they know half, you have to now contend, they think they know already. And not that I have to disprove that, but you get into debates that are like, someone says, you talk to me about God? I lived with it my whole life. You know, and what they live with is usually distortions. So what do we do? What do we as individuals do? The first thing is, you have to not be afraid to challenge your preconceptions. We all have them. I have them as well. I challenge it every day. I was once on a radio show, and there was a cynic interviewer, and he says to me, so Rabbi, you ever have a crisis of faith? That's what he says to me, like, you know, dripping with cynicism. So I said, yeah, every moment of my life. I knew what he was getting at. So he says to me, oh, really? Can you tell us about it? You know, it's like thinking like I'm like a two-year-old. So I said, let me ask you something. Do you ever have a crisis of faith? He says, I have no faith. So I have no crisis of faith. So I say, you probably think that faith is for the children who are naive and need a crutch. They don't think on their own. So they just turn to faith every time they have a dilemma. And a person like you is an open-minded person. You're a mature adult. He says, exactly what I think. That's what he said. So I said, let me tell you something. Does it bother you if an innocent child is killed for no particular reason? Or that 1.5 million innocent children was gassed by the Nazis? What, does it bother you? He says, yes, it bothers me. I said, why does it bother you? Who says there's justice in this world? There's no God, there's no justice. It's survival of the fittest. The predators win and the prey lose. Too bad. Why should it bother you? He says, it bothers me. He says, you know, it shouldn't bother you at all. You should sleep peacefully. But a person of faith who believes in God and believes in a good God and believes that good people should be rewarded is always having a crisis of faith because it bothers them when they see injustice. So I think you have the one that is in a crutch. Faith is not for the lighthearted. It's for people who've thought things through philosophically and they come to a point that realize that reality cannot be quantified by the parameters of logic. And logic has its power, but it's a computer. It can only go that far. And faith is beyond the mind, not before the mind. He was pretty silenced because he didn't expect that. You know, he thought I'm going to be some type of kid that he's going to just like dismiss and laugh off. That's the story, my friends. We have to be able to challenge. And that's why I love the idea of being with diverse people, different backgrounds, people of different levels of commitment, levels of knowledge. The one thing that was required of all of us is to be open-minded. Skepticism is healthy. Skepticism is means that, yes, you question, but you're open to hear an answer. That's not what you're like. That's not in your comfort zone. Unhealthy skepticism is a conclusion you've come to, and you're just looking to play mind games to justify your preconceived notion. And I've seen plenty of that, and there's no conversation there. So when we come together, and this is like what a base medrash really is like, the real academy, is different opinions and different minds and different challenges, all to look for what is true. And true is not in the domain of any individual. Each of us were created by God in the divine image. Each of us have that higher truth. And you know where God is? Many people think God is there. No, God is right here. It's within. It's the essence of who you are. And when anyone asks me, so how did you come to this? I say, there's a music. You hear the music. If you study Torah, not just the technical part that I spoke about, you can be a master in and not even know anything about God. But you study Torah and you study the spiritual dimension of Torah, which is Hasidic thought. It distills the mysticism into a practical blueprint that speaks to your soul. That resonates. A resonating Judaism changes everything. If our young men and women went to a synagogue and it resonated with them, you think anything could compete with a resonating, powerful spiritual message? That is our challenge. But the beauty and the good news is that we have the material. Today, thank God. Thank God to JLI, and I see Rabbi Mintz just walked in. I want to acknowledge him. Thank the JLI. Should we give him an applause? Okay. Thanks to JLI and other of its colleagues and other institutions like this have taken Torah, but not just Torah, the technical words, but the spirit of it, the spirit. The spirit of the words is music. And the God that Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Bar Dizner, the God that you don't believe in, I don't believe in, is usually the God that most people have. What we need to do is rediscover God. It's easier to do, frankly, if you never had a definition of God in the first place. If you did, then the challenge is how do you challenge your own definition? And how do you ask the right questions? And the first place to ask the question is, we're going to Shabbos soon, is always ask this question. You learn something in Torah, ask, why does that matter to me? That was always the question the Rebbe asked at the end of every talk he gave. How is that relevant to me? Now, you may not get the answer immediately, always. But the question of a wise person is half an answer. Because if you look at 98% of the Torah, it seems to be stories that are not relevant today. I'm not talking about love and charity. But if you ask, how does it matter to me? You're already asking the right question. How is the Torah relevant to my soul? God created me, created my soul. All the challenges I have, and every one of them has an answer in the Torah. Most of us don't know how to find the answer, as I mentioned before, but it's there. And if you know it and you're convinced of it, then you begin bugging your rabbis and asking them, I want answers, and don't let them off the hook. That's how you get the answers. So what is this God like? Each one of us will find an answer, but it's going to be within here. That's where it is. It's within here. It's also without us. But it's also within us. And the most important thing is that resonance. That most important thing is that relevance. That relevance. You know, time is limited. I just want to conclude on a personal note. When I was in the Rebbe's presence, and this was for years, sitting at his feet, there was godliness in the room. Why? Because here was a man that wasn't even a man in a way. A person who completely dedicated himself 24/7, and I'm talking to you as a skeptic now, not as a glassy-eyed adherent. A person 24/7 dedicated his life not to himself, not to enriching himself, not to ego, not to power, not to everything that everybody does, especially people of that caliber. Completely dedicated, I saw this, to the people around him, to empowering people like myself and like all of you, like everyone. And I never forget the Rebbe's care. Because he could have done a lot greater things than sitting with people who are not necessarily on his level. And he didn't look to build a school of elitists. It was empowerment of everyone. So in a way, I had an advantage. I was in the right place at the right time. I saw what godliness looks like. I saw that it's not about you. Now, does that mean that suddenly all of us are going to be able to suspend our egos and lose our identities? That does not happen quickly. But the journey begins by recognizing that that's somewhat of an aspiration, and that there are people that did commit themselves that way, and we're committed to that type of cause that allows us to then transcend ourselves. So though I enjoy doing what I'm doing, I enjoy standing here, I enjoy being part of community, teaching, writing, engaging, being challenged and challenging in return, that's the power of it. But at the end of the day, it's really being a dedication to a cause that's greater than yourself. So I leave you with this. To me, God, if I were to translate God in simple one sentence, would be that life is not all about you. There's a higher reality than you. That's really what it comes down to. It's quite simple, actually. And that higher reality blessed us and gave us our lives and said, build a partnership with me where you take your life and dedicate it to something greater than yourself. And that's called sanctifying your life, making it a godly life. You feel that way. You begin that journey. It's the godliest thing you can do. And I bless you all and wish upon everyone here that ability to take that courage. And that's why we're here, the synergy of this room, the synergy of the community, the group. And may God bless you all, the real God bless you all, to be able to discover the godliness in each one of you, to your families and communities and the entire world. Thank you.
What did you think about this video? Comment below and click subscribe for more videos like this.